where we speak with experts, leaders, and change makers about movements of social change that have transformed the landscape of Canada and the way we live our lives. On today's podcast, we continue the conversation about the suffrage movement with a particular focus on Nellie McClung. We speak with Bette Mueller, a historian who researched Nellie McClung extensively and shares her story. What is it about her that you've sort of gathered then?
Well, I must say that's something I've often wondered, because it seems almost incredible that a person can, at the age of 15, just turn 16, start teaching in a one-room school, and then 10 years later, they're doing recitals throughout Western Canada at least, and well into Ontario and Toronto, and then become one of the biggest spokespersons for the Vote for Women. Yeah. So I guess it has to be a combination of things, and one certainly is her own intelligence. And I think secondly, she must have had a marvelous stage presentation, because she was able to capture an audience. She must have been able to think on her feet. She, I think, gravitated to other people who were similar. And I think she just seemed to always want to get things done. She very much was a voice for the people that didn't have a voice for their own. Yeah. And she was very much, I think, a very much good community person in a small community. And then she was able to transfer that from Manitou, which was about 800 people, to the biggest city in the area, and probably in the whole prairies at that time. It was, and so yeah. It had to be a combination of determination and intelligence and opportunity, and I think a really good role model in her mother-in-law, and Nellie often mentions her. In fact, some people think Nellie has looked back and decided, I could have just chosen my husband based on the mother, his mother. And other people think Nellie really thought that way. Like, is she reading the story from her current time, or right. is she reading it from it was? But she gives her mother-in-law lots of credit for suggesting that she write, and Mrs. McClung Sr. will stay in her home and look after the four children.
So she gave her that freedom to do it.
She gave her that freedom to do it. And in a way, I think she gave her permission, which is a little bit different in a way, too. She asked her mother-in-law, said, I'll stay and look after the children. You go and get the work done. You go and get your writing started. And then once she had done sowing seeds in Danny and was asked to make speeches all over the place, starting in a church in Winnipeg, it was her mother-in-law who asked her to come there to make that speech, because her mother-in-law had now moved to Winnipeg and her husband was a minister, and they were involved in a program for girls who were homeless. And so she asked Nellie-in-law to go and give a speech, and the funds would go toward the home. And from there, other people were asking her to speak. So she does give her mother-in-law a lot of credit, and her mother-in-law was certainly an early suffragist. Nellie mentions in 1992, I think it was, or 1991, she was at a quilting party, or do, whatever it is, in a house of one of the people who lived in Manitou. And one of the women said, that Mrs. McClung is going around taking a petition for the Vote for Women. 1892, she took a petition around for the Vote for Women. And the women who were at the quilting bee hid. And Nellie said she was the only person who signed the petition. Because Nellie said if Mrs. McClung thought it was a good idea, it couldn't have been wrong.
What about her husband? Was he Nellie's husband? Was he very involved in activism, or did he support her in that?
Yes, I think he was first of all very involved in various things. Nellie talks a bit about that in her autobiography, but having looked at the local papers of the time, you see his name come up. He served in council at one point. He was involved in various organizations, and of course they were both involved in the United Church, the Methodist Church at that time. His father was the Methodist minister for some time, or a little time, in Manitou. And he does seem to have supported her. She talks very glowingly about the way with the help and Wes, things would keep going at home, and it didn't seem that their life missed a beat because of this. Yeah. I think he's remembered very fondly in the community, and I'm basing that on what I've read in the older papers.
Yeah, well, that sounds it would make sense because she got seemed to have gotten support from different, whether her husband or her mother-in-law, that seemed to have helped move her forward. It's
I think
supportive
so.
Background.
I don't think either of them really thought that they were moving forward.
Interesting.
I think they were just doing what... It was almost like Nellie wanted to be a writer. And then all of a sudden there was the opportunity, and she took it. But she didn't kind of push to be a writer.
Mm-hmm.
And she could make wonderful speeches, I understand. But her mother-in-law sort of pushed her into that. And then I think Brandon asked her to go and do the same speech there. And she did, and then someone else asked. So it's almost like her talent was discovered and just grew.
It sort of organically grew because people started...
It seems so. And then I think they went through another phase where Wes had left the drugstore, and she was finding she needed to make some money. And so she made posters and did speeches around the area and around Winnipeg.
And when you say the area originally, was that Manitou? Or how long was she in Manitou for?
Oh, she was in Manitou... let me think. In 1890... She started to teach at her first one-room country school, and that was Hazel School.
Okay. She's in Manitou.
And that was just outside Manitou.
Okay.
Yes, that was a tiny rural schoolhouse outside Manitou. And then she moved to Manitou, and for a year or a year and a half, she taught in the elementary school in Manitou. And then she left Manitou in 1911.
Oh, shit, okay.
Yes, in 1911, and Wes had taken a job. He had sold the drugstore earlier, and he had taken a job with an insurance company, so the whole family went to Winnipeg.
Okay.
And then Winnipeg from 1911, and they moved in 1914.
Okay.
But when they came to Winnipeg, Nellie felt very comfortable in lots of ways. She knew the women of the press club in Winnipeg, and these are the people that became the other suffragists along with her. But she had known them earlier, and she said the big city just gathered us in. And then they formed the Political Equality League. She was one of the founders of that, I believe. And it was through that they put on the mock parliament.
Yes.
And those women just campaigned everywhere, and Nellie was certainly one of them.
I was going to say something about the mock parliament. That says a lot about Nellie, but she worked with a group of people to put that on, right? It wasn't just her.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, I think you'd find almost everything she did. Now, I'm not including her writing and speaking to engagements earlier, but she did tend to work with a group of people, and they did plan that mock parliament when she was out of the city, I understand, and she came back from whatever campaign she was on. It could have been reading about her books or doing lectures on her books, or doing political things, or sometimes the same on the stage at the same time, and sometimes the next day she tried to do both in tours. But when she came back to Winnipeg, the other people in the Political Equality League had decided they would do the mock parliament, and they decided Nellie would be the premier. So, because she was, I think, recognized as the most effective speaker of the whole group. So.
Most vocal, probably, so she took on that role.
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
And she did a good job at it, apparently.
Well, apparently, because the papers, both local papers, wrote articles on it, and they were very glowing about the whole thing and also about Nellie's part in it.
And was that what really spurred it forward, the movement, that mock parliament? Or was there a kind of a few different events that eventually led to the women's right to vote and recognize as persons, which is a sort of a stream of a few different events?
Yes, I think the mock parliament really did push the movement on. In fact, they realized they would need to make more money if they were going to carry on the campaign in the province. And so the mock parliament was really an effort to make some money and make the whole thing clearer to those people that hadn't yet realized how important it was for women to have the vote. And they did it with humor. And that's the way Nellie tended to work. But she certainly had the group around her doing that one. And then as soon as it was over, they continued to campaign. The election was in 1915, and although they were very well recognized, the party, the Liberal Party that they were backing, did not win the election. So there was another one not that long afterwards. And by that time, the McClung family had moved to Alberta.
Okay.
And Nellie came back and campaigned for the last week before the election. And one of the local papers said that she reached the pinnacle of her career, her speaking career, her political career.
And for yourself, personally, mm-hmm. Nellie McClung is... Obviously, there's been a fascination with her.
Very much.
Can you explain where that came about in your life?
Well, it's a funny, it's my relationship with Nellie McClung, I'd never examined it until
I talked to her. People start asking about it.
Well, yes, and I said in the thing I wrote that I thought that I'd known about Nellie McClung for a long, long time, through little things and big things. And of course, I guess it was a big thing to teach in Nellie McClung Collegiate. And we were there opening night, and her daughter, Florence, came a couple of months after it opened to do an official opening.
Mm.
And I think that I've had a certain fascination with someone who could have the educational background she had, which was very little in lots of ways. You know, she started teaching at just turned 16. And she did go back for some more teaching training problems, but it's not that she studied the liberal arts and that sort of thing. And yet, I think she could have written some of the books. It's just, I find it very amazing.
Yeah.
And she just seemed to grow and keep people interested. And it seems to me that her, what drove her was this thing that we can make things better if we just do this. And if we can just keep at it and don't give up.
That was a big part of what you talked about. And she also seemed to be like, it's not only right to vote that she was pushing for. It also seemed like women's working conditions.
And oh, yes.
She was a big advocate in terms of that. Is that correct? Was that all sort of tied in terms of her activism?
I think it was. Nellie was an active member of the WCTU, the Women's Christian Temperance Union. And, of course, that was one of the many groups, although I probably the leading group, that believed that liquor should be totally abolished.
Right.
And I think from what I've read, though, that the WCTU did much more than that in small towns especially, and I think in larger places as well. I think that it provided a reading room, for instance. It provided ongoing debates. People could join the debates, and especially younger folks. And there would be some of the older teachers or people there adjudicating them. They would do plays and readings in the
right.
local opera house. And so I think that she was influenced by a lot of those things and probably influenced them as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I think some of the things she did were things that were just part of her desire to help people learn,
yeah.
to help people figure out what next to do. But I think it was also just what she was like. She was just so interested in everything. One of the things she said when she went and boarded at the Hasselfield home just outside Manitou, and that's one of the ones that's been redone yeah. there in the museum, is that she was so excited to see all the books they had in their house, because they had far more than the house that she'd lived in. And then she was able to read to the family every night. You know, and she was a 16-year-old teacher. I find that very fascinating.
Yeah, well, she seemed to be. I mean, she just seems that there was, she had taken on so many different, you know, roles yeah. as an advocate. Obviously, women being a primary, you know, focus,
yeah.
But it's not only the right to vote, women as people, as persons, working conditions, in fact,
mm-hmm.
like she seems in the prohibition. I mean, there's just like so many different elements that she has
mm-hmm.
taken on that she's pretty multidimensional in that respect.
Oh, absolutely. Well, for instance, she was one of the early advocates of women in the ministry. And because she was a Methodist, she and then the Methodist and the Presbyterian churches joined to form the United Church, she was chosen as a delegate to go to their international conference, and she was sure at that time, and this would have been in the 20s, I think, the first time she went, she was sure that they would have made a motion for women to be able to be in the pulpit of the United Churches in the country, and they didn't, and she was so disappointed at that. And disappointed again, I think, in 1934, when they didn't allow women to be ministers in the United Church.
Hmm.
And so she continued to advocate for that, to be an advocate for that. And I don't know.
Just one cause after another.
It does seem that way.
Yeah.
And that I think there, if you analyzed everything,
yeah.
you would probably see that there's this center of women and children
mm-hmm.
and other people that needed a voice, other people that needed someone to help them and lift them up and show them the way sometimes, or guide them or be guided with them. And I don't think she would ever have thought of herself that way, maybe. But from what I've read, it seems that when she came to Winnipeg, she was, I think she, let me think. When she came to Winnipeg, she was horrified in lots of ways by urban poverty.
Right.
Because rural poverty is a little bit different. I think in rural poverty, you would generally find somebody in the community who's keeping an eye on that person and helping them, or that family, and bringing them over a cup of tea or sandwiches or leftover food. And even, if nothing else, providing them with some living quarters that might not be in the big house. But it's so much more individual in a rural area, because you know everybody, and they're related to people that you know. And so when she came to Winnipeg and found like a bar in every block and grocery stores selling liquor, and the horrible working conditions, especially of women who'd come from foreign countries, and they had no way to make their lives better, Nellie was just horrified. And that's one of the first times she went to visit Premier Roblin and took him through the factories. Have you read about that? Well, she and another woman whose name I can't remember, Mrs., it doesn't matter, I can send it to you if you want to know. But she and this other woman had made arrangements to meet with Premier Roblin and to show him some of the factories, just hell holes. And he went in with them, and of course there's people, kids sitting at like big sewing machines, and one bathroom for the whole group for the whole day. And one, I think one time you were allowed to get up and leave your work site. And Roblin came out and he was just gasping for breath and utterly horrified. But he was mostly horrified that they would take him there.
Right.
Not that, you know. Yeah.
From what I understand, he was still pretty stubborn in terms of making any change, despite seeing the...
Very stubborn. He said to her, and she says this in her biography, and so do her biographer, she says it in her autobiography, that Roblin said to her, she first of all, after that then, the women in the Political Equality League, I think, wanted to meet with Roblin, and she decided to come herself and have a chat with him. And he was so condescending in that chat. He ended up and made that very famous quote that he says, nice women don't want the vote. And she said something about, well, we'll see about that, or some such thing. But Nellie said his voice dripped badness when she was talking to him at that time.
Yeah, they didn't really get along so well.
Well,
the two
not
men,
at
no.
all.
I mean, if he had stayed in Parliament, in government, would you think that women would have gotten the vote? I mean, it seems that he
no, they wouldn't have. No, he just didn't believe it. And he wasn't alone, because he was the Premier.
Yeah.
And I don't think anyone would be surprised at how he thought. And he did win that next election after the mock Parliament. But if you look at the polling numbers, it was certainly different at that time.
They're starting to be
on the website. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I've taken a look at them, because when I first read that, I thought, I guess in my mind years ago, I thought, oh, well, the mock Parliament would have made the difference. But then it didn't. But it did make a big difference.
I think it probably had, you know, one step at a time.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. And you see then, they went directly to the Liberal Party after that and said, look, if we campaign for you, will you get us the vote? But it was an astounding change in society.
Absolutely.
And a lot of women didn't think it was the best thing.
Yeah, that's the interesting part. A lot of women weren't sure.
Mm-hmm.
But thankfully, Nellie disagreed with them too, and she moved forward with the other people, obviously.
Yes. You can't overlook the fact that there were earlier suffragists in Manitoba. The Icelandic women, for instance, were very strong in their beliefs and their campaigning, and there were all kinds of other influences. But I think that Nellie just happened to be the one with that charisma at the time,
which was
certainly would have happened. But every change,
they may not have been the first, though.
No, and it may not have happened for a while
right.
either.
Right.
But she was a remarkable person. I just am amazed when I read about everything she did.
That's great. Okay, perfect. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us today on the History of Social Change podcast. I'm your host, Elisa Birnbaum, publisher and editor of Sea Change magazine and producer of the History of Social Change project. Be sure to stay tuned as we discuss other social change movements that have transformed the landscape of Canada and the way we live our lives.